Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Montana, Italy, emigrated to America in 1955, and began racing cars. He was named the Driver of the Year in 1967, 78, and 84, and is the only Driver of the Year in three decades, and is one of only two drivers to have won races in Formula One, IndyCar, World Sports Car Championship, and NASCAR. His name, synonymous with auto racing, is Mario Andretti, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a living legend, Mario Andretti. Mario, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, of course, Jack. Thank you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood in Italy and your mom and your dad, please?
All right. It all started in 1940 and in a region of Italy, which is now Croatia. It's Istria, and it became occupied by Yugoslavia right after the Second World War. And there's a reason why we were displaced. There was a choice for us to either remain under communist regime or move on and go to the mainland and maintain the Italian citizenship. So we were basically refugees for 7.5 years in Tuscany refugees in our own country. My dad was used to administer the family holdings, which was 7 parcels of farms, a total of 2,100 acres, and that was his job. And left everything behind just to maintain our Italian citizenship. In 1955, in 1952, he applied for visas to come to the States, and 3 years later, the visas came through, and it was decision time, and we came to America, and to join uncle on my mother's side, and we came right here where I live now in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, and of course, my love for the sport started. Well, we were in Italy, Italy being so prominent in motorsports, motorcycles and cars, and with Ferrari, Maserati, Alfa Romeo, being major players in the world stage in Formula One and sports cars. Obviously, as kids, I said my twin brother Aldo and I just became fascinated with the sport while still there. And our dream really, my dream, Aldo's dream began right there. It seemed like the impossible dream, of course, considering all the circumstances that we were in. But quite honestly, as far as our thinking, from the time that I saw my first Formula One race, in 1954, at age 14, in Monza, and the Mille Miglia in 1955, Mille Miglia was a 1,000-mile race, sports car race, was very famous at the time around Italy. The mold was cast at the time for us, and from there on, it was never a plan B to pursue, to be honest with you. So as soon as we arrived in America in 1955, there were hurdles to be surpassed, language, and so on and so forth. But we resumed school, of course, But luckily, Aldo and I had 3 years of English in Italy, and that helped the basics, at least the grammar. And well, we arrived here in June of 1955, and of course, by the time we enrolled in school, we had some pretty good idea how to get by in English. And and again, from there on, you know, just life progressed, and Aldo and I started building a race car 2 years after we arrived here, along with four other buddies, and we started racing professionally 2 years later, at age 19, 1959. So from there on, I never looked back.
We're talking to Mario Andretti. His mom and dad came to the States, to America, with $125. We're talking to a modern Horatio Alger story. Mario, I quote you now. "The first time I fired up a car, felt the engine shudder, and the wheel come to life in my hands. I still get that feeling every time I get in a race car."
Yes.
What's that feeling like, Mario?
Well, it's being in your element, really. It's what I thrive for. That's what I really live for. In a sense, I always had so much passion to pursue my career, and I just purely had a deep love for what I was doing. I mean, today when I sit in that two-seater, I still have adrenaline going, you know, because I take it to the limit, you know, with a passenger behind me. So it's that feeling is stay with me. It was with me from the beginning, and it continues. It's you know, as I say, it's where I feel that I belong. You know, it's something that it's hard to explain, quite honestly. But it's just for me, it's the ultimate satisfaction to. So have control, keep control of something that can actually hurt you.
Mario, I got to ask you, when you're speeding, going over the speed limit, and you get stopped by a cop, and you show him the license, what happens?
Well, usually I beg my way out of it, you know. They've been very kind to me, actually. But I the difference between speeding and I don't reckless drive. So if sometime I go over the speed limit, inadvertently, of course, as long as I don't reckless drive, you know, it's a pardonable offense. and I will not. That's one thing I don't do, and I will not do a reckless drive or put anybody in danger on the road. That so at least from that standpoint, I'm pretty good.
We're talking to Mario Andretti. Another quote. "A racing car is an animal with 1,000 adjustments." And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Mario Andretti. In 1955, at age 15, he began racing cars and began racing modifieds in 59. On dirt tracks, and then 8-9 years later, on February 26th, 1967, Mario, you won the Daytona 500. Tell us about that day.
Well, as you can see, throughout my career, I was, you know, my specialty was always open wheels, single-seaters, you know, a la Indy cars or Formula One is what I really wanted. But I was curious, you know. I did a lot of sports car racing, and at that time, I always had a great relationship with Ford because they were involved in Indy cars and, of course, stock cars. And whenever I would express my, you know, my desire to do another discipline, especially stock cars, they would accommodate me. And so in 67, I joined the Holman and Moody team. You know, I was an official Ford team. And I was alongside, at the time, he was called the Golden Boy of NASCAR, Freddie Lorenzen, who was a great champion. And again, you know, we here I was in the Daytona 500. It was my second try. The first try was with Smokey Unick the year before. But anyway, it just seemed like things worked out. I had a good car under me, and and I led 118 of 200 laps. So, you know, with among the best in stock car racing, and it provided an immense satisfaction for me, as you can imagine. You know, because especially if you win in a discipline that's not your specialty, and that this was the case. You know, to win the biggest NASCAR race, which still is actually, it's still their jewel of the series, and again, I cherish that incredibly today. In fact, last year we celebrated the 50th anniversary, which was very nice. I was invited down to Daytona, which was very nice.
We're talking to Mario Andretti, and he took the checker flag 111 times in his career. Speaking of the checker flag, the granddaddy of them all, the Indianapolis Speedway, May 30th, 1969, you win the Indy 500. Tell us about that experience.
Well, you know, as a race driver, obviously, the Indy 500 is, whether it's fair or not, is worth a championship because of its rich tradition. It's a motorsport. It's a motor race that's known around the world, no question about it. I knew about it when I was a kid in Italy. You know, so again, it defines your career in so many ways. It's unfair for drivers that have been capable of winning have never won it. You know, because of bad luck. Anyway. What really was very special for me was the fact that I was driving for Andy Granatelli of SDP fame. What brought the satisfaction was the fact that he had been trying so hard for so many years, you know, to win. And that's the only race that mattered to him. And he was always going there with something out of the box, something different. In the Roadster days, he used to be there. Everybody, you know, the off-powered Roadsters used to win the race, but he'd go there with a super-powered Novice, the big supercharged engine V8s, and they were, you know, very fast on the straightaway, but too heavy. So they had, you know, drawbacks, and then he almost won it with the 2 years in a row with the turbine engines and all of that, and here I go and win it with a very standard car, only because my radical car, which was a four-wheel drive Lotus, was coming apart during practice. In fact, I almost killed myself when the wheel came off during practice 2 days before qualifying. And what was special there is that I'd been competitive from the get-go at Indianapolis when I was a rookie in 65. I finished third, Rookie of the Year, and then I was on pole the next 2 years, and won national championships. And, you know, I won the national championship 65, 66, 67. like I said, at Indy, I was always competitive, but I could not finish it. And the second race, the fifth time there, which was the second race that I finished, I won it. That took a big, big weight off of my shoulder because, like I said, it's so important to put that under your belt, you know, for the reasons that I just told you. And I figure from there on, you know, maybe God willing, I'll be lucky enough to win a few more times. And I dominated that race, you know, more than once, you know, since. But, you know, at times where I could have just cruised home, you know, the engine always something let go, and then I couldn't finish the job. But nevertheless, here's another crown jewel that you can put a, you know, on your mantle and be proud of, and I was able to put that one away as well.
That was 49 years ago. And just a couple months ago, Will Power won the Indy 500. And he was paid $2.52 million. Do you remember, Mario, what you got paid in 69 for winning?
I think it was $246,000, I think.
Just a couple more zeros then, 49.
Couple more zeros, yeah. Times have changed.
So, another change. Let's go back to 69. Talk about the size of your team, the equipment that you brought, the number of tires, et cetera, versus what they bring today.
Well, you know, everything is relative. Even then, in 69, we arrived there with very sophisticated equipment, you know, with the Lotus that I started practice that was intended to be racing was... It was quite a marvel as far as technology at the time. Some good aerodynamic features on it, and also, like I said, the four-wheel drive, which was actually a derivative of what the turbine cars were, you know, 2 years before. They were all four-wheel drive, and we thought, and I was breaking records during practice, but the car was very fragile. So when the car, you know, when we crashed and there were some other issues with the other team cars, we reverted back to our spare car, you know, and which was not intended to be raced there, quite honestly, just as a, you know, a last-minute possibility, but... Here we go, you know, and we won the race with that. But again, you know, the equipment was state of the art at the moment. And as you know, things evolve like in all the other sports. But the motor racing being so technical, obviously, things are a little different now as far as the makeup of teams and all of that. You know, it's more professional and. And you have, you know, a lot more in-depth knowledge because of computers and all of the things, you know, that I've experienced all of that throughout my career because from decade to decade, you know, there were just immense improvements and, you know, along the technical side and the makeup of the teams and everything. So, again, but... At the time, we were absolute state-of-the-art. That's all we could ask for.
Speaking of the makeup of the teams, when we come back, we're going to ask Mario what it was like having his son, Michael, as a teammate from 89 to 92. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. We're with Mario Andretti, synonymous with auto racing. Mario, from 1989 to 1992, you and your son, Michael, were teammates at Newman Haas Racing. What was that like?
Well, Jack, I think I'd like to think that was something very special to have father and son as teammates. I think... By Michael being there with me, I think it helped me in the longevity of my career, quite honestly. I think measuring up at the age that I was against a youngster at the top of his game, you know, was something that was very good for me. And again, it gave me just, if I ever needed, a little extra incentive, you know, to keep my game alive as much as I could, you know, out of pride. And again, you know, when I look at the record that Michael and I had together as you know, in IndyCar, you know, I'm you know, it's really amazing actually. We finished well, not always when we were on podium, but we've been 1-2 We've been here. We qualified 10 times on the front row, and then you know, Michael had 5 poles and I had 5 pole positions, so we were 1-2 10 times, and again we have 15 podium finishes, 15 in IndyCar. And so again, you know, 1-2 finishes 5 times. Of course, I only won once, and I was second to him 4 times. You know, but nevertheless, like I said, it was a dream situation for me as a father. You know, to have my son on the same team. It's something that's not very usual, mainly because you know, the natural thing is just the age factor, really. But you know, timing seemed to be right, and again, I look back at that portion of my career, and then it was so incredibly rewarding. It drove my wife crazy because, you know, she thought we were so competitive against one another that there was not an inch to be given at any time. And because of that, like I said, she, poor Deanne, was just on the sideline, you know, just a nervous Nelly, as I can imagine. I remember the first time that Michael made a competitive pass on me, and we were not teammates at the time. He was driving for Krakow, and it was at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. I was leading the race, and he was just he was on me, you know, just relentlessly, and finally he just muscled his way through. Actually, we touched wheels and to a hairpin, and off he went. But the fact that he did it, the way that he did it, you know, actually irritated me. You know, I figured, doggone it, you little turkey. And then as he's disappearing in the sunset, I said, well, that's my boy, you know. So it was double-edged, you know. You know, it was something that it was irritating at, you know, in one way, and then it was beautiful in the other way. But I'll tell you another story. It was in 1986. We were not teammates yet, you know, as you can see, but he was driving for the Krakow team, and we were in Portland, Oregon, and he was leading the race, should have won that race. I was running second, right at the very last, and 3 laps to go. Monon, who apparently he was the engineer that had been in Formula One, it just passed away 2 days ago. But he was my engineer, and he's screaming on the radio, says, Michael is having problems. He's having some fuel pickup problems. So, and I was like 15 seconds behind him. And, man, I just stood on that seat. And we're coming down for the drag race on to the finish line, and I beat him by 0.07 of a second. And so we're on podium, and he's not happy, and obviously I can expect that. And then somebody mentioned to him, he says, Michael, this is Father's Day. Oh, okay, happy Father's Day, Dad. But then it's funny, on the way back on the airplane, my wife says to me, and I said, why didn't you let him win? I mean, you know, he's supposed to. I said, are you kidding? You know, so it was that kind of a thing between us, which was very healthy. You know, and he knew that he had to earn every bit of it, and me too, you know. It was... looking back, you know, we go back with a lot of fondness on things that happened. I'll tell you another story as a family, you know, because Jeff, my younger son, was also, you know, a race driver until, you know, he had his accident in 1992 at Indianapolis, you know, which basically ended his career. But in 1986, the same year, at Pocono, the Pocono 500, Michael was on pole for the 500, and I won the 500, and Jeff was on pole for the supporting race, you know, which was like the Indy Lights of today, and he won that race. So between the three of us, we cleaned the house in the entire weekend. So as you can see, you know, this sport has given us immense satisfaction as a family, And, you know, which, again, goes back to, you know, the fact that also we were teammates later on, and look what we were able to accomplish together. It was just, again, it was something that you could never, ever, you know, even imagine that could ever happen in your career, but it did.
Speaking of having to earn everything you get, let's talk about our mutual friend Joe Antonini, who was CEO of Kmart. And in 1988, he had a stable of spokespeople. He had Jacqueline Smith, the Three Angels fame, Martha Stewart, Kathy Ireland, you know, the SI swimsuit model.
Yep.
Fuzzy Zoller. And then he needed an Italiano guy, and he comes to you. Tell us about the relationship with Joe Antonini.
Well, that was actually one of the, I think, the most successful relationships was sponsorship in our sport because of the duration of it as well. Kmart being a title sponsor when he I was chairman of the board and CEO and chairman of the board. So, and again, it was just not a business relationship. It became a human relationship between us. And again, and that's lasting to today, because I strong-armed him into becoming my partner with the winery in Napa Valley that we have, and he obviously is enjoying doing that after his retirement. He and I pretty much I retired from driving just about the time that he retired from Kmart, so. One thing led to another, and I was getting involved into this winery situation, and I presented it to him, and he went along with it. And so because of that, as you can see, our relationship continues, and Joe has been a great friend, is a great man, and he's doing a fabulous job there with the winery. We're so proud of it.
He hired you for Kmart in 88. You came to Troy, Michigan. He said, would you sign a few autographs? And then it was announced on the intercom, Mario Andretti is here. Next thing you knew, 2,000 employees showed up. You signed an autograph for every one of them. When we come back, we're going to ask about Andretti Winery, Napa, California. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Mario Andretti. In 2000, he was named Driver of the Century by Associated Press and Racer Magazine. 1996, Mario, you and Joe Antonini co-found Andretti Winery. And your newest rosé, and Giuseppe Antonini says it's selling great to those millennials in Silicon Valley, is entitled Don Renzo Tambellini. Why that name, Mario?
Well, Don Renzo Tambellini was a chaplain in a refugee camp where I spent 7.5 years from age 8 to 15. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful man that was so involved with keeping us kids with activities so we obviously stay out of trouble and all that. And I was, you know, an altar boy there for many, many years, you know, for him and others. But again, he was a great spiritual leader that continued on until his passing. He was an avid race fan. Followed me when I came to the States, and whenever I would visit Italy and I would visit my folks there, I would always stop to see him at the Cathedral San Martino in Lucca. And and again, just a wonderful man, and telling Joe the story about it. He said, "Oh," he says, "with this new rosé, why don't we call it Don Renzo?" I said, "There's a story to it." And I said, "Absolutely." And that's what we're doing. Just like, you know, our reserve wines, you know, the Cab, the Chard, Merlot, and Super Tuscan is Montona, you know, Montona, which is the town where I was born. So we're maintaining that legacy. And the Don Renzo was so important in my life on a spiritual side, and helping me always. You know, you feel like you know, in times you know, tough times, you feel you need some help. You hope somebody's praying for you, and that gives you courage. And then he was just that kind of a guy, and so. We felt we would include him, you know, in some way, in a simple way, you know, in our winery, in our endeavor there. And that's the reason why we use the name.
You know, if Cardinal Dolan or one of these cardinals is listening to this, he's going to call you and say, "Mario, why don't you contribute 20% of that rosé sales to the Catholic Church?" So,
okay.
All right. Joe Antonini said, "Jack, he's the driver of the century, is as nice a human being as you're going to find, but the thing that most impresses me about Mario Andretti is his business instincts." All right, let's go to May of 2016. It's the 100th anniversary of the Indy 500, and you're driving the pace car, and you had a lady next to you. Who was that woman in the pace car with you?
Well, actually, I was driving, it's not a pace car, I was driving the two-seater. The two-seater race car, which is what started the, you know, I was the first one to go. I was ahead of the actual pace car, and which I still do that. It's a Honda program that has been deployed. They call it the fastest seat in sports. And anyway, what happens is during the parade lap, you make one parade lap, and then I go flat out and do a hot lap, and as soon as I reach the back of the field, and they give the field the green, and they go, and that's how, you know, that's how it's been in the last, it's about 6-7 years. So my passenger was Lady Gaga.
And Mario, what did you talk to Lady Gaga about?
Oh, a lot of things. She was fantastic. I had not met her before. I mean, my grandson Marco had, and so forth, but and she just went along with everything. She was so congenial with all the drivers. She and drivers' intros. She embraced everyone, and she just fit in so beautifully. And she was a bit eerie about you know, being in that race car. You know, we do a lap of 200 miles an hour. You know, just before the race starts behind me. And so she said, "Oh, gosh, you know," she said, I called my mother. I says, "Mom, I don't know if I should do this." And Mom says, "If you don't do it, I'll do it." It was really cute. I mean, yeah, it was nice. It was a very special day all around, obviously.
Well, a special day because a few hours later, your son Michael's team won.
Yeah,
the Indy 500 that day.
How about that? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, so. They put his name in it. 100th anniversary of the Indianapolis 500. You know, that was quite a thing. And, you know, Michael has been, as an owner, is a driver, has been successful. He dominated that race so many times and never was able to come to, you know, to the checkered flag. And but as an owner, he won it, I think he won it 5 or 6 times. So, you know, he's accomplishing, obviously, what his ultimate goals have been, and he's thriving. He loves being in the business, in that, you know, as an owner, and you can see his teams. I mean, he has teams, you know, even in Australia, you know, the supercar teams. He expanded in Formula E, is in Indy Lights, on the Mazda series. You know, he's just he's rally. It's a little bit of everywhere.
On October 23rd, 2006, you were awarded the highest civilian honor given by the Italian government, the Commendatore Medal. Enzo Ferrari is the only other recipient of that award in the world of automotive racing. When you put your head on the pillow that night, Mario, what did you think?
I was very, very proud. I just wish my my dad would have been still with us to see that, because my dad was so so very proud, obviously, of being, you know, an Italian, and then for me to be recognized by the Italian government in that fashion, it was really something that you know, that he would have been he would have had his chest out, you know. 2 feet, you know, if it just, it would have been so extremely, you know, just superb.
In 1955, your mom and dad came to America, settled in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. They had $125 to their name. Mario, you're a Formula One champion, an Indy 500 champion, a Daytona 500 champion. You've won 100 races. You were named driver of the century. Yet, you've stayed in Nazareth these past 60 years. Why?
Well, I say, why not? You know, it's I love this area, and you know, I claim that it's my home. It's there was. For me, no reason to go anywhere else, quite honestly. I've had some pressures to move to the West Coast because of, you know, some of my teams were located there, and I had some pressure to move to Europe when I was doing Formula One. But I never succumbed to that. And again, I raised my family here. My wife's and my parents, you know, were here, and I didn't want to leave them either. So there were a lot of reasons, and but overall, you know, this has been the center of my life, and it still is, and it will be forever. You know, so I love the community. I think it's we're in the proximity of two metropolitan areas, you know, New York and Philadelphia, for one thing. But we're just outside, just, you know, a peaceful area, and near the Poconos, you know, beautiful area. I have a great property up there. You know, I have a lake. And so I have all the things that I really could possibly want. And I'm happy being here.
In America?
In America.
You've served America for 60 years. Please keep it up. Living legend.
America, you know, that's been my... I'm a true example of the American dream, quite honestly. No question. I have a lot to be thankful for.
God bless. Our guests, please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahome.